I've been trying to decide what I want to tell you about this conversation with Riley Mulherker, and I'm struggling to find the right angle. It doesn't really matter because soon enough you'll hear it, and if you listen to the whole thing, you will experience the full depth and breadth of his career as a trumpet player at the crossroads of jazz, modern classical, and folk music, a founding member of the band The Westerlies, someone who is as intuitive as he is intellectual about the work he makes. He's a musician who's both very forward-looking and fiercely familiar with what has come before. You're going to get all that. But I've been trying to find the way to introduce him because I think that context matters. I think that when we make our own work or when we engage with someone else's, we're not entering that experience cold. We bring our total past with us. We are in the midst of an ongoing continuum. Welcome to The Third Story. I'm Leo Sidran. Riley Mulherker grew up in Seattle, the upper left enclave that's been home to so many musical innovators over the years. He went to Garfield High School, a school that has fostered countless talents going all the way back to Quincy Jones, who was himself a young trumpet player at the school in the 1940s. Riley was just 8 years old when he began seeing the legendary Garfield High School big band play free gigs in his neighborhood. It's one of the reasons he picked up the trumpet in the first place, and he was clearly meant to pick up the trumpet. By the time he got to Juilliard in New York, Riley had come up on Wynton Marsalis's radar, and Wynton became a mentor to him. If this story is sounding familiar, it's because it echoes the stories of various other guests who have appeared on this podcast and told similar stories, starting with my very first ever interview, which ended up airing as Episode 7, with trumpeter Tatum Greenblatt, another Seattle native who moved to New York with Wynton's number already in his phone. But on a deeper level, this is a story that echoes through the history of jazz, young musicians who are compelled to move to New York after only a small handful of interactions with their heroes. In the 1980s, my dad interviewed some of the most legendary figures in jazz for his radio show on NPR, and those interviews have become, for me anyway, a kind of sociological source code for the music and the conditions that created it. I'm reminded, for example, of the story that the late John Hendricks told my dad about meeting Charlie Parker, who, of course, everybody called Bird, at a gig in Toledo and then moving to New York because Bird told him that he should.
I was going to become a lawyer. My GI Bill ran out 18 months short of a law degree. And about 6 months before that happened, I had sung with Bird. He played a one-nighter in Toledo with Max Roach and Tommy Potter, Kenny Dorham, and Al Haig on piano. And I got up and scatted with him. When I got through scatting, Kenny Dorham went up to the microphone to play, so there was a vacant chair. So when I started off the bandstand, Bird literally reached out, you know, he waved me over, and I sat down next to him, and we had this hectic, about 9-minute bandstand conversation in the midst of everything going on, and Bird says, "What do you do?" I said, "I'm a law student at the University of Toledo," you know, and he said, "Oh, man, you ain't no lawyer." I said, "What do you mean?" He says, "You ain't no lawyer, man, you're a jazz singer." I said, "Well, what'll I do about that?" Being a little facetious, you know, I'm going to put this can on. He said, "Well, you got to come to New York." I said, "I don't know anybody in New York." He said, "Well, you know me." I said, "Well, where will I find you?" He said, "Just ask anybody." And as I say, about 6 months after that, I said, "Okay, we're going to New York." I arrived in New York at the bus station with a wife, a son, and about $27. I went into the phone booth, called Joe Carroll, who was an old friend of mine. I called up Joe. I said, "Where can I find Bird?" He said, "The Apollo Bar, 125th Street and 7th Avenue. I couldn't believe it. I took my wife. We went over to the Apollo Bar. Now, I had met this man on a bandstand on a one-nighter in Toledo for a period of about 11 minutes. And I was wondering, what are you going to do if he doesn't recognize you? You know what? So I walk in the club, and he's playing The Song Is You. And he's blowing, man. It's got Roy Haynes on drums, Bud is on piano, Curly Russell was on bass, and Jerry Mulligan was on tenor saxophone. I walk past the bandstand, and Bird is... "Hey, John, how you doing, man? Want to sing something?" I thought I was going crazy. So what kind of cat is that, man? And after that, he came off the bandstand, asked me where I was living, what I wanted to do. I said, "Well, I want a gig, you know." And all doors opened for me after that.
1952, maybe?
51.
Listening to John Hendricks describe not just the music, but the world around him in 1951 when he moved to New York, I can picture it so vividly. but it also feels so far removed from the realities of today. How would Charlie Parker answer today when asked where he could be found? He'd probably say something like, well, just check my Instagram stories and see where I am. So much has changed since then, and I can imagine that for a young person today, hearing a story like that would sound like it's from another planet. All the musicians that John mentions in his story have become legendary figures. And on the other hand, it's only been a couple generations since then. And those legends were, at the time, just cats playing a gig. My father heard the story from John, and then he passed it on to me, and now I'm here passing it on to you. It's one fluid continuum. That awareness informs this project, an understanding that conversations today might have added meaning in the future that we can't predict or even fully comprehend. By having them, we're jumping into a larger narrative pool. But just dipping one's toe into that pool can be an intimidating, even overwhelming experience. Best done with sensitivity and humility. Because if you know what you're getting yourself into, then you are inevitably haunted by the echoes of what came before. And this brings me back to Riley Mulherker, whose new album, his first under his own name and called simply Riley, is awash in the echoes of history, but also boldly embraces contemporary sounds and textures. It reframes classic material that was influential to him and positions his original compositions in that continuum. The album was a long time in the making. It's the result of years of experimentation and reflection, and that patience is palpable in the music. Above all, the feeling of the record is totally compelling, and feeling was at the heart of the project all along. He says he was not interested in making something that sounded like an old record, but rather that felt the way he feels when he listens to his favorite old records. Something he describes as hyper-realism. We spoke earlier this year about how the Riley album came together. He worked closely with pianist Chris Padishall and guitarist producer Rafiq Bhatia, and that team is really behind this record. We talked about his diverse career as a collaborator, a music presenter, a composer, and now a solo artist, and how thinking of jazz as a family tree helped him to find his place in the music. There are a handful of clips from my dad's interviews which are referenced and scattered throughout this episode, and you can hear all of those interviews at bensidran.com. Third-story.com is the place to go to check the archive. You know, there's hundreds of deep-diving conversations like this one, and including other trumpet players like the aforementioned episode with Tatum Greenblatt, as well as Michael Lenhart, John Lampley, Amir El-Safar, Adam O'Farrell, Philip Dizak, Philip Lassiter, Benny Banach III, Keon Harold, Ibrahim Malouf, Stephen Bernstein, and John Snyder. Also check the episodes with other Seattle natives like Aaron Parks and Casa Overall. Then check the Substack, which is where I'm starting to publish shorter form pieces as well. That's leosidran.substack.com. And remember that we are made in partnership with WBGO Studios. Visit wbgo.org/studios to find out more about all their award-winning content. Here's me and Riley Mulherker talking it down. First of all,
yeah,
I got to start with the correct pronunciation of Mulherker.
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 Yeah. That's how I've always said it. That's how my family always said it. But yeah. I'm sure in India, when you throw like an accent in there and whatnot, like, it could have a little variation.
Are your parents?
My dad, born and raised in India, came to the States after college and then met my mom in the States.
Uh-huh.
So she's not Indian. So I'm biracial in that way.
And did you go to India at all as a kid?
I did a few times. You know, my grandparents from India lived in North America for most of my childhood, splitting time between my dad's brother who lived in Calgary and then they would spend a lot of the winter with us in Seattle. And because they were, you know, they were my closest connection to India. So I wasn't going to India much at that age. And then they moved back towards the end of their life. So I had a few trips when I was like a, more like a teenager through like beginning of college to go back there and see cousins and other family that I have, but you know, just not as close relatives.
But really, you are a Seattle guy.
Totally, through and through. Yeah.
Is it one high school or two high schools with the great jazz programs?
It depends who you talk to, because actually there are a number of strong programs beyond the two sort of most famous schools. But Garfield, the school I went to, has a lineage that goes back even further than sort of the modern band program.
Yeah.
Quincy Jones went there. Yeah. Jimi Hendrix went there. Ernestine Anderson went there.
Yeah.
You know, it's a large public high school in the middle of the city. So there's just a lot of history there. Macklemore went there. But then specifically, you know, my experience was very much attached to the great jazz educators there, Clarence Acocks and also Robert Natt, who taught at the middle school level. They came from Louisiana. One of them went to Grambling. The other one went to Southern. And they were like best friends. I actually just got to see Acox last week. I was out in Seattle doing an event for him. But they brought that whole culture and knowledge of the history of the music with them to Seattle and instilled, you know, in generations of musicians, this love for the music.
Is it the school that Casa Overall went to?
Yeah, Casa went to Garfield.
Are you contemporaries, the same, about the same age?
So he was older than me, but he was of the age where when I was young, like the reason I started playing trumpet is because my babysitters played in the jazz band. So I would go hear their concerts. They used to play at the community center in my neighborhood. Casa was in the band there. Tatum was in the band.
Yes, same high school. Tatum went to also, yeah.
Tatum Greenblatt.
Yeah.
There were a bunch of trumpet players. Josh Deutsch was in the band then. Carter Yasutake, Owar Runga, who, you know, toured the world with Macklemore for years. That was my introduction to jazz and to the trumpet. And, you know, it was like clear that the trumpet players were having the most fun. So that was why.
And Aaron Parks is older and he was doing his own thing. He didn't go to that
school. He was doing his thing, but his younger sister, Anya, total trumpet phenom, and was a huge inspiration for me too, because I used to go hear her. She didn't go to Garfield, but she went to Washington, and I would like transcribe her solos from middle school band concerts because she was playing such serious trumpet. And I bump into Anya around town because she works at or she was working at Joe's Pub at the Public for a while. I don't know if she still is, but from then transcribing has always been a big thing for me too. But I forgot about those first transcriptions until now.
And Tatum was old enough that he came out here first. And were you aware of his?
I was totally aware of him. I mean, I credited him with the reason I played the trumpet when I was young, because I remember his solos. My brother studied with his dad. His dad taught all the great saxophone players coming up in Seattle. My brother played saxophone. I totally had my eyes on Tatum and his trajectory and Casa and all these kids who, you know, moved directly to New York from Garfield and pursued a career in jazz. I knew that was sort of what I wanted to do before I even got to Garfield, you know, in middle school.
It's amazing. It really sounds like the thing that was inspiring to you and maybe to other players in your generation, musicians, was seeing other kids doing it and an awareness that this was a possibility.
Completely. It wasn't, I mean, I had records and I loved the records and I would go see, you know, folks coming through town, especially in high school. I mean, it got deeper in high school, but yeah, I think for a young age, it's so much a thing of you see someone 2 years older than you, 5 years older than you, 10 years older than you doing it. And that's what really gets you going.
And when I talked to Tatum years ago, he talked about Winton coming to town and checking in on certain players.
Yeah.
You know, there was a kind of a grapevine where he would hear about who to look in on. And Tatum had a story where he took him out to the sushi lunch and started to, and talked to him about a kind of responsibility that he felt that Tatum would have if he wanted to pursue this. And
we walked around, found a sushi place, and then we walked around some more. And he just sort of gave me, you know, a laundry list of advice and perspective about moving to New York and what it meant to be a young trumpet player and what he sort of expected out of youngsters and what he thought of other youngsters and people that he thought were living up to his expectations and people that he thought that weren't. And, you know, it sort of left me with this sense of like, wow, man, I'm entering into some heavy shit here.
Yeah. And I know at some point you connected with Winton or he connected with you in high school also.
Yeah, for me, it was through coming to New York because Jazz at Lincoln Center started this festival celebrating the music of Duke Ellington. So we used to come out every spring for that festival. You know, I had known of him and his music for a long time. I actually first met him when I was 6th, 7th grade. I think I just started playing the trumpet and went backstage after one of his concerts in Seattle and told him and asked him for advice. And he told me to practice slow, which is still advice that I should be thinking about today. That was the one thing he said.
Tell me about going backstage. What happens that you, in 6th grade, you're not the only one to tell the story. I've heard this story many times of people that go backstage and meet Winton, meet the band, and have a memorable event. Your parents suggest it? Somebody says you should go back and...
I mean, they must have... I have so little memory of, like, everything leading up to the conversation, everything after it. You know, it's one of those things where I have such a vivid, visceral memory of like being in his presence and what he said and how he said it. Because also he kept on saying it and just looking at me.
Practice slow.
And I got sort of, you know, scared and ran away.
But you think about that still.
I do.
On your record, you make a point to a degree that I don't think I've ever heard of recording the sound of the trumpet to include your in-breath.
Yeah.
You hear the breathing. And I was driving yesterday and listening to the record, and I tried to match my breathing to your breathing.
Wow.
I could start to predict when it was coming.
Yeah.
But I could not hold an exhale long enough to play the lines that you were playing. So it sounds to me like you have been practicing slow, because that relationship between the in, it's a very short in and a very long out.
Right. Yeah. It means a lot to hear that you had that experience, because I don't know how people are going to relate to the music, but even more so, like, all that we put into the, hopefully, the way it hits you, because it's pretty different
The only comparison I have sonically is Phineas and Billie Eilish's production.
Okay, yeah. And that's about the only thing they say. I'm in the secondhand smoke, still just drinking canned coke. I don't need a zanny to feel better.
The relationship between stuttered effects and, you know, like, you establish on one tune, you establish this thing of like the breath is exaggerated. Uh-huh. And then you start to distort the breath, and then you start to affect the breath, and then the breath becomes, you're like having a duet between the trumpet and the breath, it almost feels like.
Right.
And like, those effects, I think, are more familiar having listened to actually music even that my daughter listens to, or contemporary popular music, than it is from any jazz context that I've ever heard.
Yeah, I mean, and they were totally an inspiration for us. And by us, I should say, I mean, the record has my name on it, but it's very much a collaboration with Rafiq Bhatia and Chris Patashall, who are the two of my best friends and the two producers for the record. And we all sort of shared this idea for what we wanted it to sound like, and specifically like the breath and the trumpet and all that. And they're the ones who were able to like take everything I was doing and find a way to make it sound the way it feels to me, but it doesn't always sound that way in a recording. You know?
Right. I read that you said, I wanted this to sound like what jazz feels like to me.
Yeah. That was like a mantra from the beginning, for sure.
Meaning what it feels like in your head and your body when you're playing it.
I think it's both. I mean, from the trumpet perspective, I think it's what it feels like for me internally, because it's a physical experience and an emotional experience. And then also I meant as a listener, like if I listen to Lester Young or if I listen to Roy Eldridge or Fats Navarro. There's a thrill and an excitement and a drama that goes beyond all the sounds that might be there on the record, but it's very much a part of it. And for me, with the record, we wanted to bring that into the space in a more sort of hyper-real way.
Hyper-real is a great way of describing it. I mean, I think in terms of all the post-production and all the sonic stuff, I also got the sense, although I don't entirely know how the record was made, and it is really one of those records where I'm like looking at it and looking at the personnel. Okay, Russell Hall and Kyle Poole are on this record.
Yeah.
But at what stage do they enter? Yeah. Because like sometimes it's really clearly played and captured, and then other times it's like it seems like there's been some elements of pre-production that had happened, or yeah. Or is it not pre-production? Is it post-production? Is it stuff that's right. later on applied to what they've done? I can't find a parallel experience to listening to your record.
Thank you. I mean, I'm thrilled to yeah. hear that.
Yeah.
It was, I mean, speaking of practicing slow, yeah. it was a slow process
yeah.
to try to achieve that sense of mystery, because pretty much every song we had to sort of make a game plan of yeah. the architecture of it before we went to the studio. Yeah. And then obviously like you improvise and have to change things in the studio, and then years of post-production design and all that. So it gets to the point where for me too, I'm like, wait, was that
yeah.
Kyle, or was that
program.
Like a reamped
yeah.
crazy distortion of something I did that now has a percussive sound to it? It all gets wrapped up in.
I mean, I appreciate the workflow also of capturing a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
So you have at the core of it an essential like aliveness, something that is spontaneous and is improvised. And then applying whatever amount of post-production and editing and layering and zhuzh that you want to. The only way to get that breath stuff, for example, of this like distorted and delay, putting delays on the breath and all that stuff, maybe I'm wrong, but it seems like they just let you play and then they chose.
Yeah, I mean, we had mics like towards my neck and yeah. around my mouth capturing all that stuff.
Yeah.
And like for the first track, I'm like on my foot to try to capture that and then treat that in a way.
That's your foot.
But that's my foot, yeah. And I love the way that Chris and Rafiq worked in that, to what you were saying, they gave me the space to improvise and not have to think about, you know, what we had talked about before or where this was going to be going in a post-production sense. And I could just try to focus on the way I would play
yeah.
any day. Like the first track, you know, that's just like an improvisation on a blues,
yeah.
you know. It was sort of taken inspiration from Jimmy Giuffre and
yeah.
but just a very simple approach. And then, you know, Rafiq goes and takes it and turns it closer and closer and closer to what my actual experience is playing it, you
yes.
know, which ends up being sort of a wild and manipulative thing.
And on that track, is that not one where in certain moments there's like a double tracked trumpet thing?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So
yeah.
is that from a different moment of the take?
So like it was one take, but we decided on the take, and then he would send me back and be like, try to remember what you played. And I would mess up a little bit, but then those moments would create some sort of interesting rub
yeah.
with the first take. And they were really pushing me in terms of bringing out sounds
yeah.
that I make on the horn that can be leaned into and sort of like they can bloom in a certain way.
Yeah.
So we were like working with all that sort of sonic material on top of the note. I could talk about Chris and Rafiq all day.
I don't know that much about them. I know that Rafiq is
a member of the band Sun Lux
yeah.
that has done tremendous things.
Yeah.
And I mean, their music is very, very special.
Yeah.
And in addition to that, I mean, in the past year or two, they've sort of done astronomical things with the score to Everything Everywhere All at Once. And then they were performing at the Oscars with David Byrne and all that stuff. This is a life. Every possibility. From destiny. I choose you and you choose me. Not only what we sow. Thank you. that's not even to mention all of Rafiq's solo work, which is just, you know, really deep and fascinating music.
And Sunlux was originally a one...
Sunlux was originally Ryan. And then Ian, who was a buddy of mine from Westerly stuff with Landlady and Adam Schatz and all that, joined along with Rafiq, who was like this guy that I never really knew. But Chris was one of my best friends from hanging at Jazz at Lincoln Center.
Were you playing with Landlady?
I used to do shows with them, uh-huh, with the Westerlies. Like, we'd be the horn section.
Uh-huh.
And Schatz has, you know, been a longtime friend and someone I love so much.
Did you hear my talk with him back in the day?
No. I got to dig it up.
My favorite moment of that conversation was we talked for a long time and I drank a lot of water and I was like, I need to step away for a minute,
yeah,
and I want you to tell me a story and I won't listen to it until I finish the episode. And then, so in the middle of the episode, he tells a beautiful story.
Yeah. He's a good storyteller.
Yeah. I'm going to go and get us a pitcher of water.
Sure.
I'd like to invite you to tell me a story or mm-hmm. something while I'm not in the room.
Okay.
And I'll discover it later.
Yeah, I wonder what that'll be. I mean, the good California story was I was just in California. I went to Santa Barbara to visit a friend who I grew up with, played music with, and he's a two-year-old now with his wife. We were on the beach in the early morning because two-year-olds wake up in the early morning, and an old man came up to us, and he was gripping a newspaper, and he said, "Do you have a watch?" We looked at him, and he said, "Do you have the time?" And we gave him the time, and he said, "In 20 minutes, a rocket's going to go off over there." And he pointed over there, and we said, "Okay, old man." And then we looked it up, and it was true that the SpaceX rocket was going to launch from the Vandenberg Air Base, which is right there, like, I don't know, a couple miles away from where we were on the beach. And so we waited and we watched an actual rocket shoot up into space with a fiery tail, and it disappeared. And then later in the video CNN posted, it lands back in the middle of the ocean on a drone ship. The end.
Perfect timing, right?
Nailed it.
So Ian and Rafiq have been a part of that band for many years now. But so I met Rafiq through Chris, who was, you know, one of my best friends. We used to go to the jam sessions at Dizzy's every week and hang all the time and play lots of music. And Chris and Rafiq grew up together in North Carolina. They got to know each other, I think, in high school. They had started working together more and more. Rafiq was producing a record of Chris's that I recorded on, and that was one of my early glimpses into how they worked in the studio.
And then, how they worked together.
Yeah, how they worked together. And then Rafiq was making an EP called Standards Volume 1, which is an awesome title and concept. It was like four or five songs, and I played on one of them. And that really got me hip to what he was able to do in a studio.
Yeah.
And I guess I actually, when I say that, what I would have thought that meant was like turning knobs and things like that. But it's really like this sort of creative way of dictating performance with the knowledge of like what can be done later.
Yes.
You know? So having me play things backwards, having me play things slowly, having me play things fast, having me react to sounds that he's sending me through the headphones. So it was actually very little knob turning and a lot of just creative imagination.
Yes.
You know?
Huh.
And so being a close friend of Chris, being totally enchanted with Rafiq, I approached them in 2018 with this idea. And they both, you know, took it on in a very generous way and have spent so many hours over the past 5 years with this music. It's insane. More than I have.
I was just about to ask.
A lot of the songs are my songs and I played them. But they're the ones who have sat with this music and shaped it and sculpted it and found ways to bring out what I was hearing and been very patient with me as I've tried to figure out what that is, you know? So it's like a heroic, it's like a hopefully a personal statement for me and like a heroic accomplishment of theirs.
Yes.
And I feel very strange talking about myself in my performance in the record, just because talking about oneself is never the most comfortable thing, but I feel really, really excited and proud of what they've done on this record. I think it's pretty extraordinary.
I agree. It's just very refreshing when something doesn't sound like other records,
right?
Even if it's evocative of other things.
You know? Yeah. And
did you feel that, I mean, you've made, like, looking at your discography with Westerlies, you've made 7 records. I don't
For
know
sure.
how many records.
Yeah.
So you've been out here making a lot of records. It's not like you haven't been documented. You've been on other people's records and stuff. But this is your first solo album.
Yeah.
Did you feel, there's a lot of ways to make a first solo album. Did you feel a sense of, I don't know, of pressure or weight or something going into, okay, this is going to be my first solo statement as a solo artist? This is like a very intentional statement that you've made.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think the word intention resonates because it felt like it had been so long that I had been procrastinating doing this when I always knew I wanted to do it, that if I was going to do it, I had to be very intentional about how to do it, what the music was going to be, and how I wanted it to come across. But at the same time, there's so much that goes into the process when it's your solo project that even if, you know, you think you know how it goes because you've been in the studio so many times and you've released other records, there's a lot that's very humbling and very new and along that process. Even though I feel like I've had a lot of experience and all that experience went into the process of making this record, it does feel like an entirely new departure from anything in that way. But all the music, I mean, it's music that has been very close to me and that I played in different contexts before in different settings, but it was like, let's take the time to document it in exactly the way that we want to for this statement.
There's like a New Orleans tune that comes in pretty quickly on the record.
Yeah, King Porter Stomp. That was one where it took us years to figure out how to find what we needed on that song. Yeah. It was an enigma. It was like impossible to break into. And then when we found it, I was like, this whole record is going to work. Because if we can figure this out. Because that's a song, it comes from Jelly Roll Morton, and he played it with King Oliver. They have like a really seminal recording of the tune, but then the composition as a whole has been like, you know, this vehicle for so many musicians in the history of jazz. Everyone from, famously, like, you got Fletcher Henderson or Benny Goodman. For me, my mentors, like, Wynton played it a lot. Ron Miles used to play it. So all these people that I was much closer to also learned from this song. So it's always been a song that I've played, but it was hard to break it out of the form it was in, you know?
Yeah.
It felt so sort of, the shell of it was just like locked in. And then once we like figured out how to break it open, crack it open in that way, and a lot of the inspiration for that came from someone I love so much, Sam Amidon, who's able to take these folk songs that have been vehicles for so many folk singers over the years and crack them open in a new way and bring in elements that might be, again, it's like this hyper-real thing.
Parking bus, I belong to that steel driving crew.
Where like you're hearing all these things and you're like, this is super electronic, but the feeling it's giving me is like getting further and further into the soil.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very much the goal with King Porter Stomp, where it's a New Orleans tune, but I think the place we take it to, we were able to create the world in it. That, again, it's like the feeling I get when I listen to King Oliver play it.
Yeah.
But it sounds a little different.
Sounds a little different.
It sounds a little different. And, you know, I think it speaks to this larger conversation, definitely as a trumpet player, but anybody that's going to deal with the history of jazz, whatever that means, or this music. I mean, there's like all this language, all this jargon that we use to, I'm not even sure where the edges are. I don't think anybody knows where the edges right. are, the boundaries are. And you talk to any number of people who have their idea of what is anchoring the music or informing the music, but you're responsible for an enormous legacy. I mean, every generation that comes along is responsible for more.
Yeah.
In a sense.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I think even Wynton, well, I'm curious where he lands on this now, you know, because I think for years the idea was you are responsible to know the history of the music before you right. can innovate within it. But I mean, when he started saying that, it was the 80s. It's been like 40 years since that initial.
Right. I remember listening to the conversation he had with your dad
yeah.
On his series. It must have been early 80s.
I was functioning under the illusion that if you just existed, you could play. I knew you had to know harmony in theory, but I had studied that in high school. But I didn't understand that you have to have intimate knowledge of the music in specific terms. Like you, if you're a musician, you're supposed to know what's on the records enough to go to the piano and play it, know what the drums are playing, the bass, the function of the horn. That's my job to know that. See, I hadn't hooked all of that up then. I didn't start hooking that up until I was like in my 19 or 20 years old. And right now I'm still trying to really understand certain things.
The trumpet tradition is a mighty tradition in jazz.
Sure, sure is, man. There's been a lot of cats who really spent hours at the craft. You know, that's the thing that I feel that since our music a lot of times is tied up in serious folklore, and the musicians add to that a lot, which is cool. It was cool for that era, but now that we're in a serious crunch, like so far as understanding the aesthetic of our music, we can't be as folkloric as we used to be. So, I mean, the main thrust now has to be craft. You know, people have got to understand that you must learn the craft of the music. The art form has a craft. And it's important for us to maintain the integrity of our form by instituting very serious, making the standards that have been set adhered to.
Where he was then was so well documented, and where he is now. And there are all so many students of his that have gone in different directions, too.
Totally. Well, I think they've gone in different directions, and there are more directions to go in today also.
Right.
Ultimately, I think that probably starts at the internet. I feel like linear history, popular cultural history, yeah. is over.
Right. Everything's just on top
yeah.
of itself.
It used to be this followed this, followed this, followed this. This was a response to this. This was,
right.
you know, and now it's like it's all happening at once, and you have all these multiple dimensional things happening.
Once right.
where somebody like you could be coming up and wanting to make a record that makes you feel the way King Oliver makes you feel, but also using all of this sonic language that so many people traditionally would have said, well, that doesn't belong in this music, or that's
mm-hmm.
not,
mm-hmm.
if we're making King Oliver music, then we're not going to use all the techniques that we can use in the studio to,
right, right.
To, you know, and, right. and you, but you're of a generation where it kind of all was happening at the same time.
Right.
Equally
right.
important,
for
equally
sure.
informative. So it's totally authentic to you to do that.
I think so. But also the engagement with technology, there were so many jazz musicians who were engaging with the technology of their time
yeah.
in ways that it also like feels in the tradition to explore the sound of the music in that way. And not to just keep bringing up your dad and all those great interviews,
yeah,
but
sure. of course.
I was on a kick just going yeah. back, because there's a conversation with Don Cherry too
yeah.
that got me thinking, because Don Cherry says the swing is in the sound.
Yeah.
Everyone thinks it's in the rhythm, but
yeah.
it's in the sound.
Yeah.
In jazz music and in all music, it's the sound that swings. It's not, I mean, the rhythm is coming from the rhythm section, but the actual sound is what really makes it swing. I mean, Lester Young is a good example of that, how he would play the simplest of phrases, but his sound had it swinging. You know,
uh-huh.
you can feel the swing within the sound.
And that resonated with me so much, and I was like, sound is the thing that we were thinking about with this record so intentionally.
Yeah.
Who knows, like, if you could have had the technology to mic things in certain ways and to, you know, reamp and post-produce and all that stuff. I mean, you're bringing out
yes.
all that swing and all that feeling through the sound.
Yeah. What's interesting is that we hear records from a certain time, recordings of a certain time that evoke a nostalgic,
right.
you know,
era that we didn't get to see, a sort of sepia-toned world that we imagine it was like. But that's actually just a document of a thing. The world was always in color, right?
Right.
I mean, this is what you're saying. The world was always in three dimensions and in color.
Yeah.
It's just that the technology that they had at the time captured it in a certain way that made us feel a certain way.
Right. And it's funny because, like, some musicians will say, I think with, like, Louis Armstrong's band, with King Oliver, they had the residency in Chicago. And I remember hearing that, like, different musicians in the band, some of them said years later, oh, we didn't sound anything like that in real life. And then others would say, that's exactly how we sounded. Like, it's documented, and that was the band, and it was so great. So it's even hard to know if, even if you were in the band.
What it was like. Well, because memory is, of course, like one of the least reliable witnesses,
right.
You know?
Yeah.
I want to ask you also, because I feel like I'm just catching up here, but Vuyo Sotashi?
Yeah.
Is that how you say?
Vuyo, yeah.
South African singer.
Yes. And so Vuyo and I first met at Jazz at Lincoln Center.
Yeah.
It was one of the first shows I ever music directed. We were celebrating the Centennial Billie Holiday, and we just sort of hit it off in this way, and everything they sing is just, it's like it comes from another planet, just like the level of like beauty and also like depth and profundity in the way that they can carry a story. So we've always been finding ways to work together, and then when I heard this song, that was just like, this could be a vehicle for Vuyo to do something extraordinary, and I'm so in love with
what happened. What is the history of the song?
The song comes from, I mean, the documentation, the first documentation I know of was from Alan Lomax visiting Parchment Farm, Mississippi State Penitentiary. It was 1948 was the recording. It existed as a spiritual folk song before then, and it has been interpreted in different ways since then. No more. But that was sort of our reference, was that recording, and we actually sampled the beat. We got permission from the Lomax estate to like rework that a little bit. So there's, you know, it's part of the song.
Turn back no more. I found in him a resting place.
And Vuyo, I don't know if this is anything that you want to speak to or not, but I hear you referring to them as they exist musically and visually in the video and everything in an honestly middle space. I didn't know what pronoun to use because it's not clear.
Yeah, I think Vuyo uses both he and they, but I know exactly what you mean. And actually, Vuyo's exploring that in a project coming up, and I don't know how much I should be talking about it, but it's a really fascinating thing when they were growing up in South Africa and how they were seen, you know, as a young singer in the chorus. So for anyone listening, definitely follow Vuyo's work because there's some really exciting sort of theatrical projects coming up around that.
Let's roll back a little bit and talk about what happened between Seattle and this record.
Yeah.
Because I was so excited about the record that I wanted to jump there. But you moved to New York after high school to go to Juilliard?
Yeah.
And studied with?
Studied with a few different teachers. Originally, Eddie Henderson was teaching me at Juilliard. Then I was working with a great trumpet player named Chris Jowdis. I also got some lessons with Joe Wilder, which was really deep. The whole time, one of my closest teachers was outside of Juilliard, Laurie Frank, who taught a long lineage of trumpet players in New York. And those were just the trumpet teachers. I mean,
yeah.
I was really close with Frank Kimbrough,
yeah,
and a number of other teachers there.
I saw one of the records in your discography is this massive project devoted to Frank Kimbrough's compositions.
Yeah. Elon Meller from Neuville Records put that whole thing together.
Yep.
And actually one of the first sessions I ever did in New York was a record of Frank's that Elon put together.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, Frank was such a generous mentor, like beyond the classroom. He would take me out, you know, on gigs, on walks, to meals, just like walking through the village, pointing out where different clubs used to be.
That's
like learning that sort of, you know, history of the music that way was so meaningful.
That's interesting. Learning where people used to play was meaningful to you.
Totally. I think it gives you a relationship to, it sort of grounds you in the place in the history of the thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's very easy to sort of get in your mind about maybe the pressures that come with going back to whatever went and said to Tatum at that one sushi lunch.
Yeah.
But
that, by the way, that is I'm probably so misquoted. Like, this is like a memory that Tatum said to me of a memory that he
had.
I love it.
I love it. But I think when you're walking the streets with someone and you're like, yeah, Gil Evans used to play there every night. I used to play at this little bar and we would play for like $25 a night and have to do like four sets and it was terrible.
Yeah.
Like all those little things. I think it personalizes the history and also reminds you how short the history of the music is.
Mm.
So it gives you a sense of how close you are to it, which I think is so valuable. You know, it's not this like ambiguous, distant thing. It's a few generations of folks, you know, and they were, you know, walking the exact same streets that we're walking today.
That's really deep commentary. And I think maybe it speaks to the tension around the idea of jazz as America's classical music, which we don't need to go too deep into, but only that, like, so, like, I think my dad, if we're going to bring my dad into the conversation, has had issues with that idea because he was very focused on this as having emerged out of an oral tradition originally.
Yeah.
And what you're describing speaks to that aspect of it, which is this has essentially been passed down from person to person, generation to generation.
Yes.
And we're all really still within a couple of generations from the source.
Completely.
Unlike what has happened to classical music, which is that, you know, the source, I mean, there's still contemporary classical music that's being made. There's chamber music. There's all kinds of great music that's still being made. But when we think of classical music, we're talking about a canon that really it's very hard to trace your, you know, lineage to the original source. It's just gone. Too many years have gone by.
Yeah.
And I like what you're saying, which is that talking to Frank and having him say, this is where we played and, you know, and I'm alive now and I'm telling you this.
Right.
This wasn't that long ago.
Yeah.
So you now become, you're sort of like implicitly tied to this now. You're part of this tradition now.
Right. I completely think of it that way. It's only a few generations. And maybe because of the sound of old records or whatever, we have this sort of, you know, as you said, this like sepia nostalgic gaze on it all. But like King Oliver playing King Porter Stomp, that was not that long ago.
Yeah.
And I think also like thinking of it as a family tree, you can relate to these people the way you might relate to a grandfather or a father, or like you might have conflict in some areas politically or whatever. You might totally get along in some ways, but there's just like a common thread that is there whether you want it or not. And like when you come to terms with that and embrace that and bring it into what you're doing, that's a lot healthier, I think, than you know, that sort of like young rash trying to prove a point with everything, you know. And it was going back to King Porter Stomp, for me it was sort of that sort of journey where it was like, when am I gonna start playing this in a way where I'm not trying to sound like these recordings I've listened to so much, but understand that like I can't run from those recordings either. And every time I play it, that's going to be there. So I might as well accept that and trust that, but also find my own way to play it.
When I heard you playing that language and hearing you, there's so many little inflections and so many little ways of getting to a note and holding a note and bending a note and all the stuff that's like inside that language that this, and I was listening to it and I was like, I don't know if this is difficult technically or not. So I could see that if you're dealing with a very difficult technical repertoire, you might say, well, that's not that's not anything that I need to worry about. That's like a very simple thing. But it's actually, it seems like it's actually, there's a lot going on with it.
I think like within the technique that it is, it's like, yeah. It's all different ways of looking at technique.
Yeah.
It makes me think of Ron Miles.
Yeah.
Who I loved so much. And he had his own technique. And he had so many ways to get from note to note that no one else did.
Hmm.
And he sort of was able to create a world within his own language, yeah. You know? And it's not easy technique. But it sounds totally different than, you know, what you might think of as the most technical trumpet playing. Roy Hargrove had his own way of doing that, where it was, you know, it could knock you out.
Okay, so you're in Juilliard. You're walking around the village with Frank Kimbrough.
Yeah.
Were you focused on jazz?
Completely, yeah.
No classical?
I always had, you know, a background doing some classical playing.
Yeah.
But I really didn't fall into the whole classical world until later with the Westerlies and sort of getting hip to chamber music and everything going on in contemporary classical music right now. But my origins, I mean, from the beginning through Juilliard, it was really jazz all the time.
Did your tone and sound change once you discovered chamber music and classical music? And got involved with the Westerlies?
I think yes and no. I don't think I went any closer to like a proper trumpet sound because that's really hard to do. I have friends who can do it and it's just like insane. You know, the trumpet is such a beast. And when you see someone who can deal with it in that way, you just feel like giving up.
what are some of the distinctions or the differences in a classical trumpet sound and a jazz trumpet sound or a pop trumpet sound?
Yeah, I mean... And even within it, like there's so many different ways of approaching it. But I think sometimes you'll hear a contemporary player who just has an ease up and down the horn. And you almost maybe even don't even hear the physicality because they have made it all feel and sound so effortless that you really just hear the sound floating out of the horn. And I'm sort of like the opposite of that, where the record is mostly like my body's grunts and breaths.
Yeah, but on the other hand, you have a very wide sound and a very round sound, and you play these really long things. And I mean, I have learned just from little things that I've written over the years that, you know, trumpet players will say, you may think that writing a lot of whole notes is easy, but it's like the hardest thing to play is long, slow things.
Right. And the Westerlies train me really well for that because we do, you know, once you learn how to play a 90-minute concert with no rest because there's no rhythm section, there's no, like, you're making sound the whole time, that helped shape the way I hear the trumpet and the way I relate to the instrument and the sense of physicality around it and what's possible. It was not a planned thing at all, but, you know, that experience changed so much the way I played more traditional straight-ahead music.
How did the Westerlies... form?
We were all Seattle guys who ended up in New York within a few years of each other. So we were hanging out a lot, listening to music a lot. And Willem, our former trombonist, first had the idea to sort of get together and play. And it was unusual instrumentation, two trumpets, two trombones. But our big mentors were Wayne Horvitz out in Seattle, Robin Holcomb, Bill Frisell, Kung Vu, all these people who instrumentation was not, it was about the music. It wasn't about like having a certain set personnel that you know, imagine. And actually our first, a lot of the early music we made was Wayne's music. We did a whole record of his music. Our first gig was at his club in Seattle. And so he really got the group going in those early years. And then we just sort of stayed with it.
There's something about a group in general that I think works on an audience level. Like, I think audiences like to engage with a band or a group. They know how to be fans of a group. They know how to follow a group. Here you are making this solo record, and even in the presentation of your solo record, you say, well, it's got my name on it, but it's actually a collaborative project. Right. But do you think that there was some benefit to having been part of a group, for being part of a group, just in terms of how it grew, how it developed, how the audience and the fans discovered it and followed it?
Yeah, I think so. I think there was benefit both like externally and also a benefit internally, in that we all were able to keep each other going even when, you know, I used to always joke that like for the first 5 years, I hated how we sound and thought it was like, I was always like, who would want to listen to this? I wouldn't want to listen to this. But I loved hanging out with them and creating with them. And then we all sort of pushed each other in different ways. And now, you know, the place that we've gotten to, I don't think it's a place that any solo, certainly not any of the four of us, but even, you know, to your point, broadly speaking.
I mean, you had a tiny desk like half a dozen years ago or something. Pretty early-ish.
And even then, like, I don't think we really had our concept together then, but we were sort of, you know, we were thrown into it and we were all like egging each other on in that way. So there was a fast trajectory for sure. It's still, you know, I'm doing this record and everything, but day to day, you know, so much of my life is that band and everything from the music to the organization of the thing, because we're a 501c3, you know, trying to keep the music afloat, commission new works, record albums, tour all the time, collaborate with a lot of folks. So it's a full time.
So that you're a 501c, the band is a 501c3, or the organization is
The band is.
Which means it's a nonprofit organization.
Yeah.
And that allows you to both receive grants and give money out?
Commission work. Accept donations like from individual donors. Yeah. So it was a model that Kronos Quartet did a long time ago. And then we sort of peeped that a lot of chamber groups were set up that way. Groups that we wanted to sort of follow in the footsteps of. Roomful of Teeth, I think, is nonprofit, and the Knights. So it's allowed us to sort of have a certain stability as well, because like we get a salary.
You take a salary
instead of, it's not much of a salary, but it's a certain stability of like, we're dedicated to this thing.
Yeah.
We put in the hours in this way.
And do you divide all sorts of bands and rock bands, every, you know, groups divide responsibility?
Yeah.
So each of you has a thing.
Like very clear job descriptions.
So what's your job description within the organization?
From day one, I was the money guy, which I don't know if I had the qualifications to do that, but I mean, at the beginning, it was just my personal checking account was the band fund.
Right.
But then eventually, so it's like, you know, everything from budgeting to fundraising and development to I do the social media and some sort of like strategic planning stuff as well. There are always a million things to do. So the job description is constantly expanding, but.
When did you encounter Anna DeVera Smith and start working with her?
Yeah, so I met her through Samora Pinderhughes.
I was just going to ask.
Who was one of my best friends in college. And she teaches a class at NYU that's this incredible class for, I don't know if they're theater majors or what school they're in NYU, but it's sort of a performance exploration class. And she used to bring in musicians just to improvise with everyone, all the students of the class. So Samora brought me along one time, and then I just, you know, kept on going back, and her presence is so magnetic and inspiring that I learned so much just from watching her teach and seeing how she holds a classroom. And then, going out and hearing her speak and then seeing her work, it's really some of the most powerful work I've ever encountered.
I just knew that it must have something to do with Samora. I just interviewed him recently, and he's so deeply influenced by her, and I think she helped him to find his own approach to using oral histories and weaving them into his work.
For sure.
And it's just interesting because, I mean, I've known her name for a long time, but it's not a name that has come up in the context of contemporary music for me a lot. Yeah. And then all of a sudden I see Samora's
name. And Vuyo used to come down to those classes too. So like we'd all be improvising together while she was directing things and really formative.
And then you ended up scoring something, a project.
I worked with her on Notes from the Field, was adapted for HBO. And I'd seen the show. She did it in New York and I witnessed it and it was so powerful. And it was actually a really cool experience for me because she was working with all these movie producers to figure out how they were going to film it.
Yeah.
And she wanted me just to come to her rehearsals.
Yeah.
To improvise with her and improvise little transitions and interludes and things like that with no intention of it being part of the score. Like she wanted it as part of her process just to
workshop,
have someone to bounce ideas with. So we would get into these sort of like duo conversation and sound improvisations. And then when, you know, fast forward some time and they were scoring the film, she invited me to come down and Lisa Fisher was doing a lot. So I got to just, you know, spend a couple days improvising with Lisa Fisher, which is pretty much the best thing ever.
Yeah. And also we talked about this, I remember before, that you also play or have played in Ryan Truesdale's Gil Evans project.
Yeah. Ryan's a close friend, and Gil's music has always meant a lot to me, and Ryan and I hit it off years and years ago, so I'm a proud member of that band.
What is it like to play? You know, it's funny when you talk about Frank Kimbrough saying, oh, this is where Gil played, I assume it's Sweet Basil that he's talking about. What is it like to actually be playing those charts? I mean, Ryan is such a diligent student of Gil's.
For sure.
To really just feel, you talk about making a record that feels like what it feels like to play.
Yeah.
To sit in the section and play Gil's arrangements.
It's powerful. You hear all these orchestrations, the French horns and the tuba and all the winds. It's like, as much as I love all the things that can be done in post-production, there's nothing like sitting in the middle of it and hearing how these like frequencies blend.
Yeah.
And I'm really grateful to Ryan that he has done so much like studious work to be able to recreate it in that way. And then, but also like all the musicians in the band are such badasses that it's not like everyone's trying to sound like the record. It's just that the music is so strong that it can't help but sound in a certain way when it gets played. Cause that's, you know, the arrangements are just so undeniably powerful in what they convey. So yeah, I mean, I've learned a lot playing in that band, and Frank, you know, played in that band too, and played, you know, I was thinking of it today because we put out the single for Honeyman, which is the last track on the album. Yeah. But that's a song that my favorite record of all time has always been Porgy and Bess, the Miles and Gil collaboration. And Frank recorded that song on one of his records too, and he used to play that song. And I played that arrangement with the Gil Evans Project, playing the Miles part. And so, you know, it was a natural fit for my album to sort of, as a tribute to all those things, from Frank to Gil and Miles and that record and everything.
So the repertoire on the record is really interesting because it really spans from fully improvised pieces to pieces that are, you know, iconic and important to you.
Mm-hmm.
It's like your, this is your life moment of repertoire.
Right. I think, there was something about when I was mapping the music out, and again, I like knowing it was going to be my first thing on my own. It was really just about like what's the most personal, what are the most personal things to me, and sometimes it's like my favorite songs, like Honeyman or Stardust.
Stardust.
And other times it was, you know, improvisations or much less formed.
There's a couple original things on the record that are like less than a minute long or a couple minutes long, right? There's
a couple like interludes where I don't even play on them, but I wrote some material and Chris played it and we were all together in the studio around the piano, preparing it in different ways, recording it, reversing it, reamping it, all that stuff.
Yeah. So when you walked in earlier today, we were talking about this other sort of shared thing that we have, which is that you spent a little time in my hometown in Madison. I can't believe that I didn't know who you were before. And I'm amazed that the way we actually ultimately met was through this little blip in your life where you had spent some time in Madison.
Yeah.
But, you know, you said, as so many New Yorkers do or people that live here, like that's maybe the most common conversation is like, are you going to stay here? Should I stay here? What should I do? Where, you know, where do you know anybody who left? Where did they go? But it's interesting to me to think that you, as a new father, would consider leaving New York. There seems to be so much here for you. Could you realistically imagine not being here?
I mean, the honest answer is I have no idea. It's hard to imagine. That's the thing about New York. It's like everything's here and you wouldn't want to be anywhere else in the world. But to your point, it's like everyone's having the same conversations where it's like, how sustainable is this thing?
Yeah.
And it feels like it's trending in the wrong direction.
Oh, totally. Totally.
So it's always, you know, there's always a question of what is essential to the community and to the work.
Yeah.
But also, you know, what is sustainable? And growing up, I was around people like Wayne and Robin who were in the thick of it in New York.
Yeah.
In the 80s and 90s, and then made a move out to Seattle.
Yeah.
And Bill Frisell did too. And they raised their kids out there, and they were making...
Was Bill Frisell there when you were there?
Yeah. I wasn't super close to him, but Andy, my bandmate in the Westerlies, was. Yeah. Maybe it's just like that was always another model that I grew up seeing of like my favorite musicians and heroes being in the neighborhood. Like Wayne and Robin used to come over to my house for like neighborhood sing-alongs. And it was the most normal thing in the world now, but, you know, I was listening to Robin's records last night being like, wow, like I grew up down the street from this person.
Yeah. Would you consider going back to Seattle?
There's so much going on in Seattle, but also as a city, like it's gotten
expensive, so
more and more expensive and seemingly, you know, I don't want to say hostile to an artist living there, but certainly not easy.
You know, one thing hearing you talk about Seattle is like, I wonder if there is just something... When you go there, it's really far away.
Right.
It's just the end of the other end of the country, just this far. And there's that sort of sense of remove. There's an insulation about it.
Yeah.
Do you think that affects the music that comes out of the place?
I think it must. I mean, you think about Nirvana or you think about even the scene that I grew up around, the improvised music scene and the creative music scene. I imagine part of, you know, what made it such a strong scene is that it's so out there on its own and no one's, you know, around here, I feel like people are always bouncing around from Philly to New York to Boston or DC or whatever, you know, there's a lot of people, you forget where exactly they live because you're going to see them all the time. Yeah. And out there, like, it's really the same people honing their craft, you know, making spaces in the communities and seeing where things go. So I was growing up in it, so I wasn't involved in it in that way of like, I wasn't building it. I was just privileged to like get to benefit from it and experience it in that way. But I imagine that's a really strong part of it.
Were your parents musicians?
Not professionally.
Yeah.
But they had an appreciation for music. My dad plays some guitar. My mom plays some piano. We had a piano in the house, which I think is huge, you know, and there was, you know, they would have musicians over to do sing-alongs and things like there's one guy in particular, David Mahler, who also was like a badass new music composer and was in New York and was doing things at Roulette and all this stuff. Ended up out in Seattle. He was introducing me to all these songs from all over the world, including, you know, Duke Ellington songs and as well as like kids' songs when I was 4 and 5 in my own house at, you know, at my piano. So
sounds wonderful.
It was, it was a pretty great place to grow up.
No, I relate to that. I mean, I saw a model of it also growing up.
Yeah.
And I think in some ways people didn't know where my dad lived. You know,
yeah.
like I think maybe some people thought that he was here, or maybe he was in LA, yeah. or, you know, and back then that just meant that he had to travel all the time. Yeah. And you travel a lot too. I mean, you're right. on the road a lot right now too, which
so
is
much.
Raises the question also of why, right. so why come back to New York if right. I'm going to be on the road anyway?
It does raise that question, but also like Brooklyn is so great, you know, I just walked over here from my place and yeah. as I'm walking down, there's nowhere else I'd rather call home. That's the impossible thing about it.
I actually think having a kid deepened my
yes.
love of it. And
yes.
especially in this neighborhood, you realize like, oh, this is actually, I didn't realize why we lived here
yeah.
until we had our daughter. And I thought, oh, right, this is like an amazing place to have
it really is.
A child.
You can walk like two blocks and yeah. you'll hit the playground.
Yeah.
You'll grab a bottle of wine. You'll pick
yeah.
up some groceries.
Yeah.
You'll grab the laundry and then you're home. And
yes.
it's like literally
yeah.
two blocks. Or I was walking here and I was like, oh, damn, that's a nice playground. We should walk down.
Yeah, it's so funny to yeah. see everything different.
Yeah.
I mean, it's an ongoing
yeah.
question, you know.
Yeah.
And I think it also speaks. I like that one of the things that you said is something like, you only said it 10 minutes ago, but I'm already going to misquote it. But it's something like, what is my value to the community? Or like, what,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
part of the responsibility is to yourself. And then part of it is
right.
to a community that you recognize yourself
right.
to be a part of. And that's a beautiful place to have arrived in your life, where you see that not only are you part of a community, but that you maybe you feel responsible to that community, that you want to do right by the people that you're involved with.
I feel that for sure. And also in this era of like everything being on top of itself, I don't know how much physical geography plays into that in the way that it would have 20 years ago.
Yeah.
But I don't like the internet stuff, you know, like
right.
I don't want it. I
right.
resist that. Like, you know, I've never been a big internet guy in that sense, like as it relates to my career or anything like that.
Yeah.
So I want the physical spaces.
But you also have this relationship with South Carolina?
South Carolina.
With this
yeah,
festival
yeah.
in South Carolina?
So I'm artistic director of a festival in Aiken, South Carolina, called Joy in Aiken. And it's a fairly random connection.
Yeah.
But it's a really lovely town that started a festival with Juilliard when I was a student. They had a couple board members from Juilliard who
yeah.
had a place down there, and they wanted to bring musicians down, or actually, you know, students of all disciplines.
Yeah.
They brought them down during spring break to give concerts, to performances. Mm. So I first went down there as a student, and then as I was graduating from Juilliard,
yeah.
the festival was also splitting from Juilliard and sort of becoming its own festival with its own board and,
yeah.
and all that stuff. So they asked me to first just get involved to do some concerts, and then it led to some curation, and then
yep.
it led on to like a full-on artistic director thing. But it's great because I get to bring so many folks from New York and wherever else.
Yeah.
Again, like serving the community, not you don't necessarily have to be in New York, because you can support
right.
the people you believe in so much who may be in New York or maybe anywhere else, and give them a gig and workshops.
Well, right, because your community is not necessarily localized in
right.
one particular place.
Right. right, yeah.
But so that's part of your kind of, your disposition is to be constantly on the lookout for what, who would I want to book?
I guess, yeah. I was just going to the conferences, all those conferences in New York at the beginning of this year. And
like all the APAP
stuff. APAP and
yeah.
CMA and all that stuff. And I guess I'm sort of a presenter now, because I also work a lot with Dave Douglas on the Festival of New Trumpet Music, doing
uh-huh.
a lot of the curation for that. And the Wesleys have a festival in Seattle. So all of a sudden,
so
I'm
three
like
festivals.
Scouting for three different festivals.
So right. So when you go to APAP, you're a presenter. You're there as a presenter.
Well, no, I think I'm there as an artist, but sometimes I remember that I should also be,
yeah.
you know, booking things for all these different festivals as well. But also, I would love to get booked at a festival for myself.
Man, you know,
somehow it's been easier to be a curator than get booked.
You know, I had a conversation the other day with our mutual friend, Michael Thurber, who
yeah.
I was out with him. We ran into a friend of his, and he introduced me in such a complimentary way. You know, he was like, this is Leo. He's got this great podcast. He's an amazing interviewer, you know.
Yeah.
And then later on, I said to him, I had this really strange feeling that I was disappointed that you introduced me as something great for something that I do. And I'm just like, I'm feeling it right now and trying to understand, why do I feel this? And
yeah.
only because he just chose to focus on one thing that I do. And when you do these multiple things,
right.
it's like you always sort of feel like it's not the full story. Like, I'm
right.
sure that you as a presenter are fantastic and people are delighted to have to be part of your festival. And and yet you also would like somebody to book you at your gig. Because
right.
at the end of the day, like, that's a huge part of the majority of what you do is you're an artist.
Yeah.
So in my case, yeah, when he introduced me as an interviewer, I was like, that's great. I'm so glad that you feel that way about me. And also like, why didn't you say that I'm a musician? You know, it doesn't matter. He can say whatever he wants. It's just me. This is my stuff
completely.
That I'm feeling.
Completely.
When you do a lot of things, it's hard to ever feel that you're fully being seen
right.
for all of it. You can't be.
Right. And at the beginning, I think you're doing a lot of things out of necessity. And then I feel for myself, like, now these are all wonderful things that I want to be doing.
Oh, yeah.
But still, like, that doesn't mean your identity has caught up with all that.
Right. And on the other hand, you do them all. You put your, as, at least I try to put as much of myself into all of them as
right.
I can, so that if you yep. never hear anything other than this conversation that you and I are having right now, you might get a sense of who I am.
Completely.
Or what I'm interested in. Or you know.
Yeah, I think so.
So, all right. So you are a presenter. Now you're a solo artist. Like, this is just happening right now.
This is the new thing. I got to come to terms with it, I guess.
And are you going to try to tour it more extensively?
I'm gonna tour it. I just have a couple of release shows, one in Seattle, the hometown, and then one in Brooklyn, the
other
hometown.
How do you do it? How are you going
to
do it?
That is what I'm trying to figure out right now. Because, I mean, it's a privileged problem to have.
Yeah.
Like, I'm on the road so much with other things that it's that classic thing where it's like when you're your own boss and no one's making you do it. And that's what doing this record was. It was like, I finally have to make space for this thing.
Yeah.
And so touring is going to be a similar thing where it's like, I need to prioritize this in a way.
And what's the format musically?
That's also to be discovered. That's, you know, I just came from a meeting with Chris Battishall. We're trying to figure out how to give the feeling that this record gives in a live setting, which means a little bit more involved sonic elements than
technically,
you know, when I go out with the Westerlies, four horns, acoustic in a hall. It's amazing. And it's also just so great how simple the background
Easy,
is. You can just roll up anywhere. And this is, you know, this is more of a production. So it's a learning experience for me, but I want to give that feeling, you know, it's not going to be exactly what the record is, but hopefully it will jolt people in a way similar that the record, I hope, does.
Are you putting the record out yourself? How's the record coming out?
So the Westerlies formed a label 4 or 5 years ago. So again, a benefit of like this whole thing beyond just the music and the band is that we have an infrastructure. So originally it was just for Westerlies records. And then we started putting out solo projects. And we actually just put out our first non-Westerlies artist. We did a record of Robin Holcomb's that came out last year.
Was there some sort of a grant that helped support the record?
Yes. Space on Ryder Farm. It's an artist residency up in Brewster, New York.
Oh, is this the Chicken Coop?
This is the Chicken Coop. I wrote that song in the Chicken Coop. I wrote Ride or Die in the Chicken Coop. So back in 2018, they had me up for a residency, and that's where I sort of mapped out all
and
the music.
And is it you working out of a former chicken
coop? So it's got the smell, but it doesn't have the chickens. But yeah, so they first it was a residency, and then they have a grant that they give to musicians specifically. And Mike Thurber was a recipient as well.
Oh, yeah.
And it's to fund, I think, usually like the first project, you know. So I received the grant a couple years ago, and that helped, you know, with the whole undertaking for sure. I mean, I don't know how I would have done it to this scale without that support.
Well, totally. And I think that that's, you know, that goes back to this idea of intention, you know, and what is the record doing? You know, why is it being made?
Right.
I think sometimes we make records because we need to have a thing to talk about.
Right.
We need to have a thing that we're promoting. We have to have a reason to book a gig or whatever, you know.
Totally.
And so it's kind of you reverse engineer your record in order to serve the needs of.
Yeah. And I mean, it's not to say like I love records that are just a documentation of where a thing is in at this moment, you know, and you'll go back to it and you'll be like, oh, it's here. And you'll hear things you didn't hear before. And there's, you know, that's one thing. And then, and also this is sort of a separate endeavor.
I got derailed. You went to Madison.
Yes.
During COVID.
Because I've got a brother-in-law there who had three kids, and they needed some help, and they offered to rent a house for us if we would help out with some childcare.
Really?
Yeah. So it was a whole family situation. And then that's when I was introduced to your dad because my wife's uncle was buddies with your dad
back in
their 20s or you know, something. playing volleyball together, yes. I heard. It was so great because it's like you hear the thing so much, like, oh, you should meet my friend's son, lives yeah. in New York and plays music. And 9 times out of 10, like, it never happens, or it's a, you know, I've just had that go wrong so many times. And then I met you and I got to talk to your dad, and it's like the deepest thing. And
I feel yeah. I was feeling the same way today as I was thinking about this, like, and it reminds me to stay open, more open,
yeah.
because you do get so many of those. I can think of a handful of people just in the neighborhood who want to talk to me about their kids or their yeah. extended yeah. family who are in music, and it's just exhausting,
yeah.
you know, but it's also but real.
Then, totally. And I got to Zoom with your dad during the pandemic
yeah.
when everything was locked down.
Yeah.
And then he gave me a bunch of the interviews that he did. Uh-huh. He put them out on the doorstep so I could just drive by.
Oh, that's cool.
And pick them up, which was the sweetest thing. And I mean, speaking of lineages, yeah. like, you hear him talking to all these people, and like, he was sharing the space and the air and the breath with them.
Yeah.
So it's really not far at all.
No, I know. But and what's interesting to me is, and I think maybe every generation is going to feel this way. Like, I look at him, he's 80. Blue Mitchell played on his first record. So
yeah,
he's still very tied to a generation of players that are no longer with us. So he now becomes the ambassador. He becomes right. the flame keeper of yeah. all of the people that he interacted with and all of the people that he talked to and all the people that he played with.
Right.
His generation is, I think, the last generation that is tied to, that had a direct contact with the first generations.
Of with the first generation. Right.
Not that Blue was the first generation, but, you know, Blue was probably only 10 years older than him or something. But, you know.
Yeah, yeah. But I wonder how they felt, you know, your own lens and perspective on it.
Exactly.
Is so shaped by yourself that, like, I wonder how far Blue Mitchell felt from Louis Armstrong. Or,
I do too, man. But that's what, even just talking about the interview that Winton did with my dad in 80, whatever it was,
yeah.
you know, early 80s. Which was only 40 years removed from the 40s.
Right.
And now that same amount of space is our removal from that conversation.
Whoa.
So that's how short the whole thing is.
Yeah. It's really short.
Speaking of yeah. really short, I hope you are not put off by this question at all.
Go for it.
The beard maintenance, your beard maintenance is so good, man.
Really?
Yeah.
I don't know what I'm doing, really. I mean,
is it a daily?
No, like every few days, but the just like handheld really razor.
Handheld razor.
Yeah. Well, not like a
straight razor.
Not a straight razor, yeah. just a Gillette something.
Do you find yourself looking at other people's beards?
Not really. I don't clock them, but I feel like you're taking care of business over
there. I don't know, man. I don't, I cleaned up for you to come over today because I was like, oh, his beard lines are so good. Riley, congratulations on this record. Dude. I'm really so excited about it.
Thank you. No, it means a lot. First of all, I mean, I have tremendous respect for what you do, and I'm a listener and a proud Patreon supporter as well.
Yes, you are. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Maybe that should have been like full disclosure at the yeah. beginning or something. But also, it's like doing this thing is surprisingly, it forces me to be surprisingly vulnerable in putting the music out there in this way.
Mm.
And knowing that you spent time with it and it resonated with you in a certain way, and getting to rap about that a little bit, it just means a lot to me, so I'm grateful.
There he was, my friends, Riley Mulherker. What a cat, what a talk. Steeped in the history, on the continuum. I'll be back again in your headspace before you know it with another deep dive. Until then, I'll talk to you soon.